that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, we're hoping to have Pastor David Whitney here with us, but in lieu of until he gets here, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Anyway, we probably should cover a little bit about what's going on in the Near East and the Mid East and the Far East, starting with North Korea. North Korea is going on a war footing. Why in heaven's name would North Korea be going on a war footing? I mean, the war that's taking place today is in the Middle East and in the Near East. And yet, of course, this is the reports that we're getting, is that the military is being called up in North Korea. What are they preparing for? And then, of course, as you know, the terrible tragedy of what's going on in the Near East is Israel is attacking Lebanon, attacking into Gaza. And of course, what they're doing, certainly I understand the rationale. We've got to get our soldiers back. But you have to understand, you don't have to kill a lot of civilians. You should not be killing a lot of civilians. And what they are doing is antagonizing the whole world. And, of course, as they go after civilian targets, because they're primarily civilian targets that they're hitting, and they've killed 300 or 400 Lebanese civilians. They've killed a few terrorists, but most of the terrorists have not been injured at all. I mean, they're continuing to lob their rockets into Israel, and of course they've put in almost 1,000 rockets into Israel, and they have about 10 or 11,000 rockets. And right now, of course, more rockets are being moved from Syria on into Lebanon to be used to attack Israel. So Israel is attacking the terrorists, Hezbollah in Lebanon. They're attacking Hamas bases in Palestine. And this whole thing is being manipulated. This whole thing was planned a decade ago. And there's a program called A Clean Break. And you can find that up on the Internet. You can Google it in. A Clean Break was a plan put together by a think tank back in, I think, 1996, talking about how Israel was going to have to attack Lebanon. They were going to have to attack Syria. But before they could do that, they would have to get rid of Iraq. And that's exactly what's happened. If you read this program that came out of a think tank, and it was, of course, put together primarily by Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and a handful of other people who, in my estimation, have no loyalty to Israel. They were laying the basis for creating a great war that will have disastrous effects on Israel and on the people of Israel and on the people of Lebanon and on the people and the Palestinian population at all, because nobody wins from a war. And yet, this was planned at least a decade ago, initially the attack on Lebanon and then the attack on Syria. Well, if they attack Syria, of course, Syria has a non-aggression pact with Iran, and then, of course, that'll bring Iran into the war. And we're on the edge of World War III. And the average American living in the tranquility of our nation has little or no idea what's going on. And with that as a background, we have with us from back in Maryland, our good friend, Pastor David Whitney. Hi, David. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Dr. Stan. How are you tonight?
Well, that's sort of like asking Mrs. Lincoln. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the program? No, I was just thinking, of course, what's going on in the world today. But we have to talk about, really, about our Constitution, because if we don't understand our Constitution, we can't understand what's going on today. We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor Whitney. Well, David, why don't you pick the story up?
Well, we have been talking about the first three articles of the Constitution up to this point in time over the past several months, and it's easy to remember an outline of the Constitution because the very first three articles deal with the legislative branch, Article 1, the executive branch, Article 2, and then the judiciary, Article 3. Now, as we come to Article 4, the main topic is the relation among the states. And it's interesting to note what Thomas Jefferson said. He said that the states should be watchful to note every material usurpation of their rights, denounce them as they occur in the most peremptory terms, to protest against them as wrongs to which our present submission should be considered not as an acknowledgement of, or precedence of rights, but as a temporary yielding to lesser evil until their accumulation shall overweigh that of separation.
And I think, really, it was the men who founded this country had an intense fear of a highly centralized power. They wanted to limit the power of the central government so men could be free and have matters dealing with life and liberty and property taken care of at the state and the local level. And the federal government was never to have anything to do with the individual, because if the federal government could control the individual, he would be able to terrorize him into submission. And just as kings have done and rulers have done and dictators have done and emperors have done down through the ages, America was different because we limited the power of the federal government. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, yes. And actually, the states were to be one of the major checks upon the federal power. And most people don't understand that today, because the states have been reduced from that noble role that our founders designed for them. They've been reduced to kind of mere political subdivisions of the federal government these days. But they were, their function actually was to kind of keep the wall around the federal government. That is what the Constitution states. Well, the states were to keep that wall upright, erect, and impregnable so that the federal government would not break out of the jurisdictional boundaries established by our Constitution and our Bill of Rights in which they were to function. And so Article 4 deals with the relations among the states, and it's important to remember why they had to draw this up. You understand the history of what took place as soon as the Declaration of Independence was signed. The next item of business when the Congress reconvened was to draw what ultimately became the Articles of Confederation, the way the government, the central government, that is, would function in relationship to the states and so on. And there were some great weaknesses, and we've talked about this before, but there's some great weaknesses in those Articles of Confederation, particularly in how the states related to one another. For example, the issue of citizenship. If you were a citizen in one state and you crossed the state border...
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Our guest, of course, is Pastor David Whitney, and we're talking about really our Constitution and the construction of the Constitution. We've got to Article 4. And you can't understand our way of life unless you understand the Constitution, which is not taught in colleges, it's not taught in high schools, it's not even taught in law school. You see, there are people who don't want the American people to understand that the Constitution was a restrictive covenant limiting the power of the federal government so it could never become tyrannical. And that message has been forgotten, intentionally suppressed, and our knowledge of the Constitution. Pastor David, and they work very hard, classes all across America, to... They don't learn in college what they will never learn in law school. Distinguishing Constitution of America from every other nation in the world. Go ahead, David.
Well, the thing is, the time of the Articles of Confederation, that if a citizen from one state crossed the boundary into another state, his rights as a citizen were not respected. Often, if there was trade between those states, interstate commerce, those interstate commerce transactions were not handled right. The boundaries of conflict, there was a whole host of conflicts taking place among the states on many different levels. And so Article 4 of our Constitution was really designed to deal with those problems that occurred during that era of the Articles of Confederation. Well, Section 1 of Article 4 deals with the full faith and credit between the states. That is, enactments of one state are to be given judicial enforcement. With very few exceptions, each state must be valid and give judicial enforcement to the states.
Well, of course, that's what they want to get at least some states to legalize same-sex marriage.
Exactly.
So that they will be forced then all states to accept it. That's what it's about, isn't it?
That's right, because the faith and credit clause in Article 4, Section 1 is very careful. Now, the courts have ruled that there are some exceptions. Before we talk about the exceptions, let's talk about the obvious application, where it's a given. For example, if someone goes to Nevada and gets a divorce or even gets a marriage there in Nevada, that divorce or that marriage must be recognized as valid by the state of Alabama. But the question comes in, what if same-sex marriage exists, which Massachusetts does? Obviously, that's directly opposed to the public policy of all other 49 states. Well, the courts have ruled that if it is an opposed to the public policy, it has to be the clearly policy of another state, that state does not have to apply the full faith and credit between the states. But a debatable area, you know, one way at one point in time, they may turn around and rule the other way at another point in time. Another example that comes to mind is a will that is executed in one state. Say if a will is valid in North Dakota, and that same will must be accepted in Mississippi, even if the terms of how many witnesses there are to the will may be different or the other. And so a person who has their will in North Dakota and they happen to be traveling in Mississippi, they die there or their relatives are there, that will must be accepted by Mississippi. Again, the exceptions to this, the courts have deemed, are situations in which the legal enactments of one state are manifestly against the public policy of another state. And, of course, homosexual marriage would be the test case for this all across our country, which is why any state that wants to protect itself from this attack on God's holy institution of marriage has to put the highest legal enactment into place that would prevent that from taking place. And so it's very important. For example, we're fighting that battle here in the state of Maryland, where a judge, a lowly judge actually, a circuit court judge in Baltimore, has said, oh, Maryland's law, which is on the statute book, says marriage is only between a man and a woman. She says, oh, no, that law is no longer constitutional, but the Constitution of the state of Maryland allows for same-sex marriage, she claims. Well, of course, there's a legal battle going on, and it's going up to the Supreme Court of the state of Maryland. But when these sort of battles take place, we need to understand that our founders never intended that the laws of nature and nature's God would ever be violated by the structure of our civil government. So when we talk about these issues, the reason why there's even a debate on these issues at all is the American people are letting the politicians get away from the foundation of our country. Laws of nature and nature's God are undeniable, but because most Americans don't understand that, and don't understand that God's law, if it's violated at all, is in our legal structure, any of those legal enactments, any of those judicial opinions, all of those things are invalid if they go against the very foundation of our nation, the laws of nature, and nature's God.
And I think, David, it's so important people understand that the Declaration of Independence, which talked about the gods of nature and nature's God, was looked upon by the founders of this country as certainly like the Articles of Incorporation of a corporation, and that was the basis of the Constitution. You know, it was... You cannot separate the Declaration from the Constitution. In fact, in the Constitution itself, it talks about how this is ratified on such a date, you know, and then it goes back and said, and such so many years and from the foundation of this country, which was the Declaration of Independence. So even in the Constitution, they specifically referred to the Declaration of Independence because that was the foundation of this country, and built upon nature's God and nature's law. And of course, that has all been removed, and you go back and read the writings of the Founding Fathers, they always went back to the Declaration of Independence. They don't today, because most of them don't believe in the Declaration of Independence, and so many who even profess a belief in God don't really believe in Him.
And part of that, as we know, is the miseducation across the legal system in our land, that the lawyers themselves have been mistrained by their law professors to believe that somehow anything that our founders said can be ignored, and all you need to listen to are the judicial opinions of judges who have violated the law, have broken the law, have basically made the law null and void. And that's part of the whole problem we have in our land today, that lawyers are miseducated. Actually, the average layperson is far better at understanding the foundation of law designed by our founders, and being able to look at that, you know, read the documents, the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, read those documents for themselves, and understand what those documents say, rather than understanding the lies that are put forward by the lawyers who want to destroy the foundations of our nation.
Let me just comment on the in Article 7 of the Constitution. This is where they, of course, ratify it. And they say the ratification of the Convention of the convention of nine states will be sufficient for the establishment of the Constitution between these states, so ratifying the same. Done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states present on the 17th day of September, in the year of our Lord 1780, seven and of the independence of the United States of America, the 12th. In other words, 12 years since the Declaration of Independence, and of course in the day of our Lord, 1787. So people really don't understand that even in the Constitution they refer back to the Declaration. Everybody understood how important it was then. They don't even read it on the 4th of July anymore.
And it's tragic that even those who will read it often misunderstand the terms and the phrases, because that language has been lost to us. But that's what Institute on the Constitution is all about, the retraining Americans. Really, in basic civics, it's something that any American can discover, read, and understand for themselves, and come to be part of this great movement that, Dr. Stan, I'm so thankful to be on your program, because you are part of the great movement to restore our republic, which is really the only hope we have for liberty. If we do not restore the republic, we are all going to be slaves, well, of the New World Order, I guess, is what you would conclude. It's coming at a very rapid pace, and we have great work to do in order to restore the republic before our rights are stripped away and our freedoms are stripped away from us.
And I would simply like to repeat what I mentioned in the last hour, and that is, if for people who say it could never happen here, I would simply ask them to go to the computer and Google in Halliburton detention camps and find out that they have recently given the Halliburton Corporation, of course, which Dick Cheney was so closely affiliated with and received a deferred salary from for many years after he became vice president. They gave Halliburton a contract for $380 million to build detention camps in America. Now, why would they spend $380 million to build detention camps? Who are they going to put in them? They obviously have a plan, but they do not want the American people to know. And people say it could never happen here. And I would ask, not why not, if God is just? His justice will not sleep forever. Go ahead, David.
Well, and just to make an additional note, they even say in their official documentation for that, not only to detain immigrants, that is, illegal aliens coming into the country, but for new programs. What in the world are those new programs? Every American should be very concerned that our freedoms are under dire threat. Well, coming back here to the Constitution, Article 4, Section 2 deals with what's called the Privileges and Immunities Clause. A state may not grant rights or privileges to state residents only. And here was part of the problem during the time of the Articles of Confederation. If you cross the state border, all of a sudden the new state wouldn't treat you that gave its own citizens. Well, this clarified that a state may not limit rights or privileges to its state residents only. It must grant the same privileges to residents of other states. One of the United States, and that's an odd way to phrase it in our way of thinking today, but we need to understand states were the sovereign powers that established the federal government. They're the ones that created the Constitution. It was the federal government that created the states. No, the federal government is the state, and the sovereign entities had citizens of their state.
Hold on, I'll be back here in just a moment with David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is the story there.
Well, and as sovereign citizens of each state, the boundary between one state and another, you have the rights of that state. If you are the sovereign citizen of Well, of course, today we know the privileges of citizenship are being handed out to illegal aliens who have invaded our country. That's here of the Privileges and Immunities Clause. It's that you are a citizen of one of the states of the Union, and as a citizen of that state, you have the same privileges and immunities as any of the citizens of that state themselves. For example, think about hunting and fishing licenses, that if you're from out of state and you want to do some fishing or hunting, you have the privilege to do that just like the state residents. However, the state may charge a higher rate for non-residents because non-residents, they're not paying the taxes that the resident of that state is paying, so there's some effect there. Attending state universities where it's legitimate and lawful to have tuition much higher than resident tuition because, again, the resident, either they or... So they allow for equalizing the fact that a resident has to pay taxes to support and lands and that sort of thing. But the privileges and immunities are the same for a citizen of one state as another state. Two is extradition. Upon a government, another state must extradite. For example, the governor of Virginia could request that the extradite to Virginia a fugitive from justice that they found there. And so each state has that right. A criminal who has escaped from their criminal, any criminal just run for the state border as fast as they could as soon as they got across the state. There is exception if the fugitive was also wanted in the town for a crime there. For example, a governor of Virginia requested New York extradite someone to Virginia. Well, if New York that individual for a crime, New York may try him and make him serve his sentence, actually, before extraditing him to Virginia. So suppose he had 10 years. Well, they didn't have to extradite him to Virginia until that 10 years had been served on that court. But since the governor of each state is the well-being of all the persons, the governor might refuse to extradite and will not receive it. Humane, just treatment in the receiving state. And there's a very interesting story that took place between two states. The requested that the governor of California, who was Governor Brown, accused of murder, I believe it was, with the Indian uprising that took place, one of those Indian uprisings in South Dakota. Anyway, he had murdered some people in the process of the uprising and then escaped to California. But California... Governor Brown, California, knew that South Dakota had a death penalty. And so he had reason to believe that if he extradited this prisoner to South Dakota, he would face trial, and if truly convicted of murder, he would be put to death. He would face the death penalty. Now, of course, Governor Brown completely refused to extradite from California.
Hold that thought. Well, this is our guest is Pastor David Whitney, and he's talking about there was a clause there. Can we another state extradite a criminal so that a man couldn't, say, escape from South Dakota and run to California free? And ordinarily, they would extradite the man to Dakota, but David is talking about this one. He was wanted in South Dakota. And he fled to California, and our governor at the time was Jerry, the attorney general here in the state of California. But at that time, he was the governor of the state of California. He didn't believe in the death penalty, and he knew he said that he would be executed, which he probably should have been. So Governor Brown refused to extradite this criminal back to South Dakota. You want to tell the rest of the story, David?
Yes, it's very humorous because the governor of South Dakota, who was a feisty fellow, he wasn't about to take this lying down and say, oh, well, I can't do anything about it. No, he began to allow some criminals to be paroled from his prison system, providing that those parolees would establish residence in California. Hilarious. I mean, he was wildly popular in South Dakota for having done this, because the people in South Dakota were appalled that this murderer, as they believed was a murderer, had not been brought to justice, had not faced trial for the crimes he committed there in South Dakota. So people applauded him there in South Dakota.
Let me point out that, many people have been murdered in the United States by Mexicans who have fled to Mexico. Not one of those people who have fled to Mexico has ever been extradited back to the United States. So all these murders, you can commit a murder here if you're Mexican, get into Mexico, and they're not going to send you back again. And we ought to ask ourselves, is this really the sort of country we want to be affiliated with? And in this new program that George Bush has put out, where we're going to unite America and the United States and Mexico and Canada into one big, happy, new country that the North American community, which is, of course, on the books right now, it's only a matter of time before it'll be implemented. But Mexico has been protecting all these murderers. So if you're Mexican and you want to get away with murder, while you just flee to Mexico, you don't have to worry about being extradited. And we're talking about dozens and dozens of instances where this has happened. And isn't it amazing we never tell the American people about it?
And it's criminal is what it is. It's criminal on the part of their government to protect murderers. And that was the point of this extradition clause in Article 4, Section 2, that states would not allow justice to be violated by holding a criminal in their state and preventing that criminal from being extradited to the state where he committed the crime, and for a trial to be held and justice to be done. Another example of this that's a little more distant from us in history was that during the time of slavery, fugitive slaves legally did not become free by moving to a free state. You know, they might have crossed the river, or maybe the Missouri River, whatever, from one slave state to a free state. That did not make them free legally, because of the privileges and immunities and extradition clause. It meant that the state who received the slave must treat that slave with the laws of the state prior, so that what happened is that there was a fight that developed between the slave states and the free states, especially over the extradition of fugitive slaves. And many of the states in the North would refuse to extradite a slave into any southern state. And so that whole prelude basically was a lead up to the war between the states, which really wasn't about slavery, although, you know, they sold it as if it was an issue about slavery. States were going to retain their rights.
And of course, that led up to the Dred Scott decision, didn't it?
Yes. Declared that, you know, that they were chattel or property and not at all human beings, which we know certainly they are. Those issues are important to remember, that the structure that was designed was wisely designed a structure in which the states retained their sovereignty. States. They didn't lose their sovereignty to the Union. In other words, they retained sovereignty as separate independent states joined together in this Union. And again, that's an idea that most Americans don't have in their thinking, because most Americans have bought the lie that the federal government is all and all, and the states are just mere political subdivisions of no great importance whatsoever. And that was the opposite of our founders. They knew that if you ever have a monopoly of government, then you will not have freedom. You will have tyranny.
In fact, that's what Thomas Jefferson said. He said, "I fear for my country." And then he went on to say, "When all power shall be centralized in Washington, D.C., then we will have a government as venal as the one we have just recently been separated from." And that's exactly what those who want a dictatorship in America actually are encouraging today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is, of course, Pastor David Whitney. David, why don't you pick up the story there?
Well, moving from Section 2 of Article 4, Section 3 of Article 4 deals with the admission of new states into the Union. From the very beginning here, at this early in time, they recognized that it wasn't just going to be the first 13 states that had declared independence that were going to become part of this union of states, but that there would be additional states. The Northwest Ordinance, of course, dealt with the first group of states that came into the country. And so wisely they planned in what they were designing here, a way in which new states could join this union. And again, you need to remember these new states were joining this union as sovereign states. And the process by which those sovereign states would join is very important because, like any organization, when you think of it, the way to destroy an organization is to have new people come in or new entities come into the organization that are not really committed to the purposes or the plan or the goal of that organization. And that kind of infiltration will ultimately undermine the entire organization. So basically what they had to do in the admission of new states is put together a process by which these new states would come in to assure these new states were committed to the same form of government that was already established here. So Section 3 of Article 4 deals with restrictions. No state may be formed entirely within the borders of another state without the consent of that state's legislature. No state may be formed from territory of another state without that state's legislature, the consent of that state's legislature. And that's a very interesting example in history of exactly this happening. Of course, there's a debate as to whether it was legitimate or illegitimate, but during the time of the war between the states, Virginia, a section of Virginia, basically separated from Virginia to form what we call today West Virginia. Now, the question is whether they legally did that. And there's a debate, of course, about whether the together to do that really was representing. And one example in history, say, within the boundaries of an state. Of course, the debate also entails, well, Virginia had seceded from the Union at this point in time. Virginia was seceded. Sort of thing, but in principle.
We're going to be back here in just a moment with Pastor. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And before I go on, because I'll forget about it if we don't, let's go ahead and get your telephone number, get your web page out, and we'll know how to get a hold of you. Begin to put on these courses that you offer so they can become part of this army of people all across America who are beginning to rekindle that flame of understanding, that flame of freedom that once made America great, that freedom which has been. Institution. How can they learn how an institution that's in grammar school or in high school or at college or law school? And certainly most of our ministers have no idea what our Constitution entails.
Interested in what we're teaching at the Institute on the Constitution said, I said, we put together this host kit, and the host kit to communicate, say you're hosting a class, you're really not teaching it. Dr. Eidsmo in 12 lectures covers the historic law and government and gives you a working knowledge of the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, all the material walking through here on these radio programs is the core of this course, Institute on the Constitution. And it's 12 lectures on DVD with a student notebook and a host manual giving a host as to what they need to know and do to conduct a. And people can purchase this host kit by. That toll free number is 8-7-3-9-7-9-8-6-6-7-7-9-6. Go to our website and actually go to our web store and purchase it online. IOTCOnline.com. That's IOTCOnline.com. And we encourage people to do this in their churches. I said, yeah, this would be great to use in my church to either as a Sunday school class or as a midweek class to educate the people in our church. These, Dr. Stan, these are really just as a Christian citizen in, you need to know the Constitution because you need to evaluate that Constitution. Making all kinds of promises now in the election cycle. Well, you're going to vote for him on November or vote for another or say me. And of course, during the time that they're serving down in Washington, D.C., we need to be communicating with them about particular bills and whether they're abiding by the terms of our contract, which is what this Constitution is, our contract with our government in Washington, D.C. Across the country, 47 states being hosted, people being educated and waking up about the design our founders structured and about how off we are from that design today. And the path back begins by educating and then ultimately by replacing any legislator.
I agree with the talk.
Well, going back to Section 3 of Article 4 of New States, it said rules regarding the admission of the Union. Now, what normally is Congress will pass what's called an Enabling Act, and that authorizes a territory. Territory is given instruction a constitutional to form their state constitution, and the Congress specifies certain provisions. The state constitution must contain provisions in a moment, but so basically the structure it needs to hold its convention, adopt its constitution. The territory has adopted a constitution, it sends it to Congress, and Congress is to look at that constitution and either approve of it or disapprove of it or send it back to the state. Congress has authority to govern those territories, states, just as it has a right to and responsibility to govern all federal property. Washington, D.C., fall into that legitimate governance over property on the part of Congress. Usually, of course, Congress will establish a territorial government that exercises supervisory control until a statehood is a territory. Now, Section 4 of Article 4 contains in our Constitution, and it is this. One of the extremely important measures of whether the it will be accepted or will be that Section 4 of Article 4, the United States guarantees that each state shall have a Republican government. That's Republican small r. We're not talking about the political party now. We're talking about the form of government.
That occurs never to be a democracy. I mean, this was our founding fathers. They knew that democracy Bush always talks about a democracy. John Kerry always talks about a democracy. They know the difference, but they want to deceive us and convince the United States that every state is required by law to be a republic.
And many people today have been deceived by those lies. They believe we're a democracy, and I've talked to people. Hey, what's the big difference? You know, maybe we're a democratic republic. Democracy, 51% of the people law. In a republic, law is established on the laws of nature and nature's God, which is God's Bible. And that's a huge difference between a democracy where 51% of the people in Germany can say, hey, it's fine to throw. It's not fine. You can't. Because that's a violation of God's law, the laws of nature, and nature's God. So before a state is, Congress has to make sure that that state has a republican, that is a representative form of government with absolute fixed law. No man is a law unto himself. Everyone is officials, and that is a government elected by representatives of government. There must be three branches of government. Each state must, for example, open to our Constitution and the 47 articles in Maryland's Declaration of Rights. State must have those essentially as part of its constitution for it to be accepted as a state in our union. Now, the next thing in Section 4 is that the United States also protects states against two other threats to Republican government. And it's important to understand that these are threats to Republican government. First is foreign invasion. We see, as you've mentioned many times, we see a foreign invasion across our southern border that our government is doing a terrible job in even attempting to address it, and people have said, they're doing the best they can. Well, no, they're not. Look at the border with North and South Korea. How many years have we been guarding that border? Was it 1958 or something like that, or 57? We've been guarding that border, and not one person's made it across that that zone. But here in our own country, we're not defending that southern border, and it is indeed an invasion that's coming across that border. And that's the job of the federal government, to protect the states along that border, Texas, Arizona, California, to protect them from invasion. And furthermore, the second aspect of this is to protect from domestic insurrection. That is, those individuals who in the country itself would seek to overthrow the government. Well, that's interesting. Overthrow what form of government? A Republican form of government. So it is the duty and job of the federal government to prevent the destruction of our republic. And the enemies of our republic may be foreign, that is an attack from outside, or they, that is from within, the termites are eating away at the foundation of the house, and you may not see it. Ultimately, a house that's being eaten by termites is going to come crumbling down. And that's what's happening in our constitutional republic. The termites of this lie about we're a democracy, the termites of the violation of the Constitution that goes on day in, day out in Washington, D.C., all of these things are like termites, foundations of our constitutional republic. And if it's not stopped, if it's not repelled, ultimately our constitutional republic will come crashing down. And our rights that are God-given rights that are secured by our form of government will be violated by those tyrants who refuse to obey the laws of nature and nature's God.
Amen. Okay, go ahead.
Well, moving from Article 4, and again, this, remember the outline, legislative, executive, judiciary, states, which is Article 4, we come to Article 5, and Article 5 is the amendment article, how the Constitution can be changed if change is necessary. It's interesting to see what George Washington said in his farewell address, which, by the way, used to be the most important political statement ever that every school child read before they graduated from high school, that they studied in detail. About, I think it was 70, 80 years ago, that began to be dropped in school curriculums, and now no school child reads it at all.
And of course, this is because there is a conscious, organized effort financed by the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford, to change our form of government, to change our form of education, to totally what is taught school, and of course to introduce them into this idea of, because that is the great wealth in this country, change the structure of our society and make it all controlled from centralized authority. You know, but farewell address is so vital to be able to actually recite it. Go ahead, David.
And it's easy to search on the web, and you can, you just want to download it. It's about amendment, as he said in the 1797 farewell address. It's in the opinion of the people, distribution or modification of powers be in any particular wrong. And if we, in crafting this Constitution, somehow, somewhere, we got it wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment the Constitution designates. But let there be no change by usurpation. For though this, in one instance, may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. He's saying there's many other ways that people are going to try to alter our form of government. Don't let them do it.
And of course,
that's the process of amendment.
And that is what the Supreme Court has done, and that is why they have been so fearful that people would get onto the Supreme Court who believed in the Constitution and would not use their judicial power to alter our form of government. They have been doing this going back all the way to the 1930s when the Masons took control of the United States Supreme Court, and they have continued doing it even control in the 70s of another court who would use judicial power to actually alter our form of government. Now, stopped it at any time, and President Bush could, by invoking Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says that you limit the appellate court jurisdiction. Nobody ever talks about that anymore, because there really are those who want an authoritarian government in Washington, D.C.
And the other aspect of that we've talked about, when we look at the executive branch, I said many of the president's executive orders, because he's amending our form of government without going through the amendment process. And as we look at the details, we'll see it is extremely difficult to amend the Constitution. And that's by design. They knew that unless it was an extremely difficult process, the amendment would take place and we really would not preserve a Republican form of government, Republican small r. And as Washington warned, that's the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed.
And you know, I was just going to say that President Bush has been adding signing statements to all the laws he signs.
Yes.
He's used hundreds of these saying, well, I'm not going to abide by this law that you passed. How can the president refuse to abide by the law? He just does it and nobody objects.
He basically says he is above the law. He's a law unto himself, and that's extremely dangerous because that's the words of a tyrant. Anyone who is above God's law is a tyrant. And we see that around us today. Well, just briefly looking at the details of how the amendment to take place, our founders and for amending the Constitution. First was the approval of both houses of Congress. The amendment would go through both houses of Congress, House and Senate, be sent to the states. The other path for amending the legislatures, in other words, they were saying it was not an amendment, but the state legislatures, thirds of the state legislatures called upon Congress to have a constitution. Congress would be obliged to call for a constitutional convention that were proposed. So whichever means were to be used, ultimately the amendment, when it passed through that process, must be ratified by three-quarters of the state, and that is either by the state legislatures themselves ratifying the amendment convention that would take place, and by the way, Congress direct which means would be used, that is, whether the state legislatures or each state convention, and so on. Well, actually, our Constitution has been amended, you could say, one time in the Bill of Rights, and then following that one time with what we call amendments, in addition to that, times, so for a total of 27. All of these have been by the root, that is, both houses of Congress, two-thirds vote to amend the Constitution, once it's got for ratifying process in the state. Quarters of the states must ratify that it actually would be
difficult as possible, so that, you know, you would be faced with a dictatorship in America. But, of course, they've gotten around it. They got through the 16th Amendment. It was never passed by the state. It instead we passed the 17th Amendment. So even felt the Founding Fathers did. There have always been those who would centralize all power with Washington, D.C. The 16th Amendment gave them massive amounts of money. The 17th Amendment did away with states' rights in many respects. It gave direct election of senators rather than election by the states. Why? Because it was a step along the way converting us from a republic to a democracy. In the United States, some of the finest goodbye. They're not elected by the states. They're elected by the people who put up to get them elected. And we vote for, not for the candidate of our choice, but for the candidate of their choice. David, one more time.
866-790-9796. That's 866-730-9796. IOTCOnline.com. That's IOTC
online. Why don't you go ahead and
complete here. We never have had an amendment take place for our Constitution yet, except by the root of calling for not taken place. And there's some who say, well, you know, it's about time for doing something like that, but we ought to consider if Constitutional Convention were to be called, because the Constitution itself does not really specify how delegates would be selected for that Constitutional Convention or what the rules of procedure would be followed, and that means ultimately Congress would be one to choose those delegates or select how they're selected, and Congress would probably determine the procedures for that convention. And there is no guarantee that the delegates to a new convention would share the framers' view of human nature, the framers' philosophy of government, the framers' fear of the power of government. And in other words, we don't have people today in our day, although we're working on it as we train people across the country at the Institute on the Constitution, we don't have a large number of people yet who hold the founders' worldview regarding law and government. Therefore, there'd be no assurance that the convention could be one that would secure and protect our God-given rights, which is the whole purpose of government, to secure and protect our God-given rights. And, of course, there's no assurance that if a convention was called, that it could be limited to one single amendment, say the marriage amendment or whatever you want to talk about. I don't agree with that, but anyway, that's another discussion. But there's no guarantee you could limit it to a single amendment. Or even a whole new constitution when the first group was gathered that formed to amend the Articles of Confederation. And they went far beyond that in creating a whole new constitution. So there's a danger of the Constitutional Convention to an entirely new constitution. James Madison, who's usually called the father of our constitution in 1788, having witnessed the difficulties and which assembled under every propitious circumstances, I should tremble for the result of a second. I think it would be wise to listen to our founder there, that we don't want a constitutional convention. Mm-hmm. We don't want that. If there's anything to be done, it should be by the amendment process that's taken place through Congress, as it has 27 times to date.
We're out of time, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
We'll look
forward to
talking.
And you too. We'll look forward to having you back again here on Radio Liberty very soon.
It's my privilege.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoy our programs with David Whitney, and I hope you'll give serious consideration to getting a kit and starting to teach your neighbors and your friends about the miracle of America. Teach your family. They need to know what America was all about and how we lost it. And then, of course, we have, of course, a four-tape set called The Faith of Our Founding Fathers, some of my interviews with Dr. James Herson. We carry, of course, books like The Faith of Our Founding Fathers by Tim LaHaye, Abandonment Theology by John Salfont, The Wall of Separation, going into this lie that there's a wall of separation between church and state. One of the greatest books we have is America's God and Country by William Federer. That's America's God and Country. And then, of course, we, of course, also carry David Barton's original intent. So if you're going to try to learn about America, David Barton's original intent, America's God and Country, Abandonment Theology, The Wall of Separation. Oh, one of the other great books is by John Stormer, and that, of course, that goes into Betrayed by the Bench. That's the title, Betrayed by the Bench. We actually have Phyllis Schlafly's book on the supremacists, the story of the Supreme Court. But what nobody will tell you is that the reason we began to lose America was because the Masons took control of the United States Supreme Court in 1941 and controlled it until 1971 in majorities of 5-4 to 8-1. Why won't anybody tell you that? Well, some of them don't know, but some of them are quite afraid to be controversial and to point out that there really is within our country secret societies, not just the Masons, but the Theosophists and the Rosicrucians and the Bohemian Grove and the Skull and Bone Society and the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a front for a secret society. And then, of course, you've got the Bilderbergers and the Trilateralists, the Club of Rome, and you've got the Sabbateans, and you've got so many secret organizations that most people have never heard of. And our job, of course, is to try to get the information out. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it, and you need to distribute it far and wide. And, of course, another thing, you can get the DVD or the VHS, the VCR copy of my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you want to get pretty elaborate, you can get the Secrets of the Illuminati. That is a talk we gave for the Prophecy Club, and it's basically the story of the Brotherhood of Darkness, but half again as long, with a lot of overheads and a lot of documentation there that you'll see. And some people prefer that, some people prefer the simple first talk. Doesn't really matter. The whole idea is to get you to understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle against secret societies that are not imaginary. They're working at the upper echelons of our government. They have actually created the enemies of communism and socialism and humanism. They've infiltrated our churches and our courts and our schools, and we're going to lose America unless you're willing to challenge me and try to prove me wrong. Get the information. Go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And then if you'd like a free copy of one of my newsletters, fine. Remember our number, it's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Get the information, find out if it's really true. And then have the courage to take a stand to tell others what's going on. They're mobilizing for war in North Korea today. 900,000 Lebanese have fled into Syria. The Near East is in chaos. The Middle East is in chaos. Will it be the Far East before long? Do you think we can sit here idly and of course, drum up wars throughout the rest of the world without eventually, of course, having to face what's going on? Pray for America. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. I believe we're entering one of the most difficult and dangerous times. Certainly pray for peace in Jerusalem, but, well, I just hope it would come about. And so until Monday the same time, may the Lord be with you.